Welcome to Deep Talk, Master Your Skills in Grant Writing, a podcast hosted by the Team Grant Acquisition at the University for Continuing Education, CREMS. With this podcast series, we want to help you to master your skills in grant writing to make it an easy and fun task within your research. Each episode deals with a different topic relevant for the application for funding within the largest research and innovation program worldwide, Horizon Europe.
Hello and welcome to the third episode of the podcast series Deep Talk, Master Your Skills in EU Grant Writing. Today, we will talk about the benefits of failing when applying for funding under Horizon Europe Pillar 2. We will answer questions such as, how can failing improve future proposal writing? How to use a rejected proposal in another way? How can the experience of failing enhance the research team's resilience? How can researchers benefit of failing? These questions and much more will be answered today by our guest, Professor Tobias Slay. Tobias is University Professor for Continuing Education Processes in Digitally Supported Teaching and Learning, and head of the Center for Digitization in Lifelong Learning at the University for Continuing Education, CREMS, since 2021. Before, he was Professor for Learning Analytics and Educational Innovation at Tallinn University. He has a PhD and habilitation in psychology and knowledge management from the University of Graz. Tobias is an acknowledged expert in the fields of learning psychology, educational technology, and innovation. He has published over 100 scientific articles throughout his work. His research has received several awards. He has headed interdisciplinary research groups in the fields of educational technology and innovation, and has played a leading role in several large-scale EU-funded research projects. This year, Tobias applied with his team for Horizon Europe Pillar 2 with the project TAIKO, Teacher AI Complementarity. After a couple of previous failed attempts, this time his project as coordinator got the funding granted, and we want to hear all about it. With this in mind, we are thrilled to welcome Tobias. It is great to have you here today. Let's deep talk. Tobias, tell us a bit about your background and experience with Horizon Europe proposals.
Thank you for inviting me. It was very useful for myself also to think a bit about those proposals and what they mean and how to maybe improve things. So my own history actually goes back now 20 years in Horizon. Before that, it was not called actually Horizon. It was called FP6, FP7, so those framework programs. And we applied the first time, I think, in 2004 for an FP6 project in the ICT area. My boss at that time was the main person behind the project proposal, and I was there as an early postdoc, and took over writing of one work package, and also included one of my then PhD students into this project. And it was a big surprise that we actually won this grant. It was a grant over 12 million euros. The projects at that time were much, much bigger than they are today. it was a big surprise, and we embarked on this journey of coordination basically fairly unprepared. And I even was then nominated as the deputy scientific coordinator, and I had to take over the coordination of this project for a few months, because my boss was having her babies. And from that on, basically, I have spent the last 20 years writing EU grant proposals. I have counted there should be at least around 25 to 30 proposals I've written over the last 20 years, and probably around 8 to 10 of them I have been acting as a coordinator. So for me, this was kind of like a natural development, I would say, that I have gone through in my scientific career. The programs always changed a bit. We started off with quite these big projects on ICT, on technology enhanced learning, which was then a big topic in the EU agenda. And then, yeah, the calls changed, and now the calls are focusing much more on really societal challenges, digital transformation, for example. And that's where, yeah, we also had to adapt and shift the focus a bit over the years. And that is where then, I guess, this Tycho story started maybe 6 years ago, when we submitted the first proposal on AI in education. And that was, that was the starting point of the Tycho story, which has now basically come to an end.
Very good. I also want to ask you, if you had, while applying finally for Tycho, mm-hmm. any other options in mind for third-party funding, or did you even apply for it in parallel?
Mm. Those 25 to 30 projects I mentioned are only Horizon. So, of course, in addition to those, there were also applications to national funding agencies, the Austrian, the Estonian ones. There were also other EU-level programs like CHANCE, so the humanities and social science funding programs. So there were lots more, and so I would say a general advice maybe, or a general way of how I see it, is that, I mean, the same project is not, of course, submitted several times. It's more like that you have particular strengths, you have particular ideas, you have particular knowledge that you can bring in, and then you form a proposal that is kind of adapted to the particular call. And it's basically what happens is basically a configuration and reconfiguration of your of those things that you can bring in to the proposal, your capacities and your knowledge and your skills and so on. So therefore, I wouldn't say that we submitted ever the same proposal to different calls, but of course, many of the elements that we brought in have been the same in all of those calls.
I guess this makes it very difficult to resubmit every time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So exactly. So we are coming to this resubmission when I talk about those three failed, or the two failed ones, later. But in general, yes, this is the hardest thing about it, is that, as I said, you have certain capabilities and capacities that you have to know yourself what they are, and some sort of scientific contribution that you can make. And this, of course, you have built up over many, many years. It is something that you cannot change very, very well. Yeah. So this is going to stay stable basically over the many years. And then you have on the other side those calls that are talking sometimes about very different things. And now you have to find a way of how to configure what you can bring to the table to answer exactly those challenges that are mentioned in this call. And that is what is maybe one of the main challenges in Horizon. And yeah, it is not impossible, as you see. Yeah, so we have submitted so many proposals. Some of them were successful. Some of them weren't. And yeah, so it is possible, but it requires, of course, a lot of thinking and work.
Talking about learning from mistakes, mm-hmm. what specific lessons did you learn from failed proposals?
Yeah, so I can tell this story about three times submitting, I wouldn't say the same proposal, but the same idea over, I would say it was now maybe six or 7 years. So it was this Tycho teacher AI complementarity, and we started off with a project that I don't even exactly know what it was about, but it was something to do with the synergies between AI and the use of AI in education. And it was fitting very well to one call many years ago, and we established a project consortium with whom we worked very intensely on this project. It had a nice complementarity between the roles of people. We got to know each other very well, and these are also the highest level researchers in Europe you can find around this topic. And the project was not funded, but it was evaluated very successfully, very highly. So I think we passed this threshold, but not enough that it was funded. And this experience was generally a very positive one, and we were all very excited about it, and the motivation was very high. And here I can say that this high motivation after this proposal is a little bit of a double-edged sword, because the next time we applied was for a different call. It was on emerging technologies in education, and AI was mentioned. And then we thought, oh, perfect, we can just basically submit the same idea to this call, because we're also dealing with emerging technologies. And so we started preparing and rewriting the proposal, of course, and so on and so on. But already during the preparation, it turned out that maybe the original idea didn't really fit so exactly into this call, or we would have had to change it much, much more. But because we were so motivated and we were so convinced of this original idea, we didn't, and we got so positive feedback, then we didn't have this motivation to really change the proposal a lot. And we maybe also ignored feedback that was coming during the process, where people were saying, yeah, okay, but you know, maybe you should also consider those other emerging technologies that there are, and so on and so on. So I think, yeah, this motivation that we had was a bit of a roadblock for us. And yeah, the result was clear. Yeah, so the proposal was rejected because it didn't. It was also praised that we have a great team and whatever, but in the end, it didn't really fit so perfectly into the call than other proposals that were submitted. And then, of course, the motivation went down, and we said, yeah, okay, well, this is very, very unfortunate. But again, this double-edged sword of this, in this case, negative motivation, it helped us then to say the next time, yeah, okay, now we have to, let's keep our strength and what we want to do in the back of our mind, but let's now really analyze what this call that we submitted to on AI and human complementarity really wants from us. And then we analyzed it very deeply. We discussed it quite heavily. We actually started with the impact section in this proposal, because this kind of should drive on a very broad level, you know, what we are reaching for, and then we basically reconceptualized this idea, and the motivation was very high again. Everyone was committed. Everyone was really happy about it. And yeah, then it was funded. So I guess, the story here is that failed proposals can have very different effects on you and sometimes raise the motivation, sometimes lower the motivation, but that's not necessarily a good indicator of how successful you will be the next time.
Indeed. You already mentioned the changes made, but what do you believe was the key to the success of your proposal?
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, of course, as I said, the match between the expected outcomes, which are very explicitly written in those calls, on the one hand, and the results we're promising to produce. So we kind of changed a little bit our logic, maybe to previous attempts in applying, and we really were discussing about the results. This is interesting because this is not a concept that is actually mentioned anywhere in the proposal templates or in the you have to talk about deliverables, about tasks, about milestones, but there's not really a mention of you have to define the results. But for this proposal, we said, okay, let's define the key results we want to now produce. And of course, these are related to the tasks and to the deliverables. They are also related, of course, to the methodology of how we want to produce them. And very importantly, they are also related to the impact, because the results you should somehow use in such a way that they are interesting for some stakeholders, policymakers in our case, who will then take this up and say, yeah, okay, this is interesting, but what shall I do now with it? So I think one key thing was finding defining those results, getting agreement from everyone, and then making this kind of the central hub that where everything was coming together. So I think this was, I would say, an important lesson in this last round. Key was, of course, also that we had this team that had already been collaborating for, 6 years on different initiatives. So yeah, these three proposals were only one part of it, where everybody knew what each other was bringing in, where there was trust among the partners, where it was clear that they would say, no, I think this is not a good idea because of that reason, rather than just saying, yeah, okay, I remain quiet because I don't want any conflicts. So all these things is a very important aspect of having a good team. And this team doesn't have to be very big. Yeah. So in our case now it were maybe 4 or 5 key people. And I have experienced this also in the previous applications, in my previous life, that it's very good to have this nucleus team, let's say, and it shouldn't be bigger than, let's say, those 4 or 5. This is a good number with whom you really develop this idea. And then you bring in, of course, other people, other partners which are required, and then they go along with this key team of 4 or 5. And this is a very important that you find those people and you can really work with and you can trust.
You mentioned as well policy experts. Did you have contact with them?
Yeah, this is now another very important key to making successful proposals. So I have to start a little bit from earlier times. So in FP6 and FP7, the big thing was interdisciplinary work and research. So there you had a key selling point and an advantage if, as a group, you could demonstrate that you can integrate different disciplines and produce some results. Not just that you have collaborated with other disciplines, that is, of course, the starting point, but that you could present, hey, I have been developing some models, some technologies, some theories, which clearly link different disciplines to each other. And this was a key, and we had it at the time, and suddenly we got invited to all those grant proposals because the researchers were looking for people who were integrating, who could be demonstrably integrate different disciplines. Now in Horizon, this is still important, and you have a big advantage if you can demonstrate it. But what has come in Horizon much more to the foreground now is that you also have to show capabilities of translating the research into some sort of societal application. That can be some industrial application, it can be some policy making, it can be innovations in schools, in universities, in museums, in whatever. Yeah? So, and if you can demonstrate that you can do that, then you are very, very attractive to any kind of other people who are working on these proposals, because they need you to be able to demonstrate this. And this capacity to translate can, of course, be built up systematically in a university or in a department. So you can create spaces like we are trying to do now, We are building up a lab that is supposed to be functioning like a living lab, involving other involving outside stakeholders and so on. We did a similar process in Tallinn, where we created a living lab for educational innovation, where we could demonstrate, hey, look, we have brought in so and so many hundreds of teachers and students into this lab, and they have been working with us together. We have created some research and innovation with them. We have invited policymakers to visit us in those labs. So these spaces are extremely important. That you can show, yes, here, look, we can do all of that. And now I come back to the policymaker question. And if you have, of course, engaged policymakers previously in these kinds of things, then it's much easier that for the next time you can ask them again and be involved. So maybe here I can also say that we had a previous project, which was a ministry from the Ministry of Education, Austrian Ministry of Education, a project that was basically asking us to do some studies on digital competence in education. And at first, it didn't seem like a very scientific project. And maybe as a scientist, you would have said, yeah, okay, why should I do this now? I could do much more exciting things. But we still did this project. We worked together with this ministry, people. They were happy about what we did. And then, of course, we had a direct link for Tyco or for other EU projects with them, where we could say, hey, we are now planning a follow-up. Do you want to join us again? And do you have some feedback for us? And then they are happy to do that, because you have this prior experience with them. So, yeah, it's kind of thinking strategically about this kind of societal or policy-making inclusion, yeah.
And what about policy experts that you discuss here in the university with?
Mm-hmm.
I remember you mentioned it.
I think here in the university, I was too new to really make the connections. That is another feature of the local team, let's say, a very important role that you can bring. That you can bring your ideas to the local team, and they can help you make connections locally, and this is definitely what happened, like in this process with the Ministry of Education, where let's say the local people said, yeah, okay, I can you know involve this and this person, and maybe we talk to them and so on. So that is a key thing for that local team to work.
Yeah, and diving into today's topic, benefits of failing.
Mm-hmm.
How have these failures or rejected proposals benefited you in your professional growth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would say in those 20 years, I had many failed proposals. Yeah, so you can make the calculation. probably 80% have failed. And I had to, learn that these failures, so to say, or non-funded proposals, let's call them that way, and not failures, because a non-funded proposal can still be a very very good idea and very very great success, but it might not be funded in the end for various reasons. But anyways, from these rejected proposals, I think I had to learn how to disconnect these experiences of getting negative results from my own person or from my own strength and competence. So I had to learn that I shouldn't start questioning my own competence too much just because of some, yeah, non-funded proposals. So I think this was something that I had to learn. And the second thing that I had to now also convey this message to partners and to younger researchers, to colleagues, to PhD students, because I was noticing that, of course, they were also taking this negative feedback very heavily sometimes, falling into some, yeah, demotivation and falling into some holes where they had difficulties to get out for themselves again. So I had to also become a mentor to younger colleagues and help them to understand what this meant and how to go on from there. So I think this was very important for me also.
For your last proposal for Tyco, how long did the proposal development itself took? And is it worth it, the effort and the resources?
Mm-hmm. So I would say altogether we started then 1 year, about 1 year before, not about the writing, but about having these initial discussions with those key partners I had already. So it means sending to them this call text, sending to them the idea, short sketches of ideas, discussing with them who else they would like to involve, discussing new priorities they have, new centers they have established, how does it fit, and so on. So all these discussions probably took a few months. And then I would say maybe 8 months or something like that, which was spent with quite concrete preparation then for this proposal, looking for other partners, conceptualizing the idea, defining those results, setting up the template, start working on the impact, and so on and so on. So, is it worth the effort? Yeah. So for me, this was never a question because I have, as I said, grown up in this. So for me, it's the most normal thing to do that you have to communicate your ideas to someone to convince them that this is something that is worthwhile to undertake. And you have to communicate this idea sometimes to funders, but also to your colleagues, to the university, to your junior research staff. So I think this is, for me, in a sense, is a normal part of a scientist's life, that you have to formulate, justify your ideas and tell them to somebody else. Now, and then, of course, the funders are requiring quite heavy additional justification and formats and so on and so on. But I have come to accept that that's just a necessity, and therefore I just do it. In terms of the effort required, as I said, we had already developed many ideas and also the models and also the relationships already for over the last 6 years. Developing a proposal always also is a kind of learning, a further learning, further development experience. Yeah, so it means you develop the ideas further, you make them stronger, you justify them better, you embed them into certain current discourses. This is all you have to do anyways, even if you're not writing a proposal. So all of this is not, of course, not lost time. And it's just an opportunity to motivate her to spend this time with the other partners. Yeah, writing a grant also gives you the chance to motivate your international colleagues to sit around a table with you and discuss important topics with them, because otherwise you meet on conferences, but okay, then you present some papers, you maybe have a short chat in the break, but there's not really this intense development and further discussion of things. And this is a chance you have when you can say, hey, let's do that, in the end maybe we get a nice grant for it. So I wouldn't consider it necessarily as a, I'm not only looking at it as a kind of effortful thing.
Very linked to the previous question, do you have any recommendation for the researchers who failed at their first attempt on how to use their rejected proposal in alternative ways?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so first of all, the motivational downturn, of course, you have to somehow survive and you have to tell yourself that it's not about you and it's many reasons and so on and so on. So that's, you need to find someone who kind of can build you up again. And the second thing is then, I think what you should do as a researcher, you should try to extract from this proposal what in this proposal is something that is your unique thing that you are bringing there to the table. And this has to do on the one hand with your strengths and with your competence and your knowledge that you have created and your methods that you have developed, but also it is connected with your own motivation and identity as a researcher, that you really say, I really want to work on this thing. So you have to extract, like, what are these things, what are these elements that are really you in this proposal. And if you have been able to find these, then you can describe them, you can talk to talk about them to other people and so on. And then you find opportunities where to apply, where to embed this kind of your own nucleus into other proposals. And then, of course, you can reuse the text and justifications and so on from those proposals. But the important thing is that you understand, okay, this is what I want to actually do. And then, of course, you have to be open that these things will have to be somehow contextualized into some grant proposal schemes that maybe you have to work a bit on understanding what they actually want from you.
And what about using this research for publications or collaborations or networks?
So we have also done that. We have published papers on both successful and failed proposals. That is a good opportunity. It's very easy then to motivate the partners to say, okay, now we have spent so much time on writing this, so let's submit it to somewhere. So that's a very good thing. You can use it, of course, for organizing events like scientific workshops or mini conferences or something like that, where you say, okay, let's take this topic and let's invite other people to contribute to it also or to discuss things. These are some of the typical things that can be done. A special interest group, you can found a special interest group in your scientific professional association around this topic. So there's just many different
opportunities. What about collaboration and networking? Did the rejections open new opportunities in these areas?
So they both opened, they both strengthened very much the existing ones. Because with every proposal, even if it's not successful, you are kind of strengthening the ties and building trust with your established networks. And then they know they trust you because they have seen, okay, this person is capable of, you know, bringing everything together and submitting it. And, now it's at least, at least submitted. So that's the one thing. So strengthening existing ties. And then, of course, the proposals always make you aware of other people, institutions, stakeholders, which you weren't aware before. Either they are brought in by these existing partners or you stumble upon them. And then you have to have some very deep conversations with them about this proposal, so you get to know them a little bit. And very frequently I have kind of filled up a list of potential networking and collaboration partners from this, and then I've contacted them again, maybe even 2-3 years later for some other initiative. So that is something that is happening there as well.
And what about after Tycho? I have seen that you have been invited to a couple of new projects.
Yeah, I think this happens naturally if you, as I said, if you are a little bit visible in this EU arena, and people know what you can bring and so on, then yeah, you get these invitations. And this is also, of course, how those 25 to 30 proposals have come together. So these were very many of them were just proposals where I was invited to contribute. This can go very, very different in very different ways and forms. So sometimes I was not really belonging to this central circle, but I was just contributing. Sometimes I was also contributing more in the inner circle to these. So yeah, they can go many ways. And I've learned that that your gut feeling when you submit this proposal, if you're really honest to yourself, is this now really a winning idea and really good? And are you personally really behind this? I have learned that this is quite a good indicator of how the proposal will in the end be evaluated. So if you have already yourself some doubts, or you're not sure, or you have contributed, but you're not really behind it and so on, then the chances are very high that this is also what the result will bring. And if you are really a lot behind it and you're motivated and so on, then there's a much higher chance that it will also be funded, or at least evaluated very positively.
We have heard about your successful journey embracing setbacks and staying resilient when applying to Horizon Europe. To close, I kindly ask you to advise other fellow researchers by providing them with 5 practical quick tips on how to benefit of failing.
Yeah, so I think I've already mentioned a few, and so maybe just to summarize. So yeah, the one thing is the and I'm unfortunately missing a good other word for it. So find your unique selling point. I know it sounds a little bit like marketing talk, but find this nucleus where you can really contribute something, where you have experience, where you have competence, where you have knowledge, and where also you have the motivation and identity that, yeah, this is my thing. This is something you have to identify, and you have to, and this you can find, and you can find an application for this in many, many contexts. So that would be the first thing. The second thing, of course, the community and building up the networks. And if you are, and I would very much advise you to become member of some networks, professional associations, whatever, and to play a bit more of an active role there. Yeah. So then you get visibility, you get people who are talking to you, you can yourself discuss things with them and so on. So you also pick up what are the developments, where is this community moving, what are the new trends and topics, what are the calls maybe that are around. So this is important. Connected with this, I think a good general hint is that you should monitor a bit the calls and the EU strategies and agendas, not only what is written in the calls, but also try to find out what is behind that, who are the expert groups who have composed this, where is this coming from, how is my community connected to this or not. So just monitoring a bit the EU journey. Yeah, and then the third, fourth one, I would say this, think about the transfer mechanisms. Think about how you can build up in your own institution, in your own department, or just for yourself, the capacity to show you can transfer scientific results into practical applications. Yeah, you can build up labs, you can build up centers, you can just start a podcast, or you can, participate in policy dialogue. So there's so many different things you can do. You should find the one that you feel most comfortable with and then follow this. So again, you have to find a way where you can really say, yes, this is something I'm convinced of. It's not just I'm doing it because I have to do it for those proposals, but it's something that I enjoy, I like doing, and it's like me who's doing this. And yeah, maybe the last thing, find that trusted group of people. Ideally, they are international colleagues, because for EU projects you always need international colleagues rather than your own institution. So find 3, 4, 5 very close collaborators whom you trust and with whom you can work together with, who can give you honest feedback, and who you can trust that if they say yes, I will support you, then they will support you.
Thank you so much, Tobias, for sharing your experience with us, and we wish you success for your Horizon Europe project, TAIC. Dear listeners, for more information about the work of Tobias, please follow the link in the footnotes and visit his profile at the University for Continuing Education, CREMS. For further information about Horizon Europe and explanation about the funding program, please visit the InfoWiki website of the Grant Acquisition Office at the UVK. Thank you very much for listening, and good luck with your proposal preparation.